Hi, I'm Brooke, and you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast spreading awareness of wrongful conviction and problems in the justice system. And I need to open this episode of Actual Innocence by saying I am so sorry, and today has been a terrible day. Let me tell you what happened. So after a lot of misfortune and discombobulations and health issues throughout the week, DeMarco and I had set a time a little bit earlier to record the ads and the opening and closing to this episode. So we did it. There were no issues. Well, there were not very many issues. Nothing we couldn't handle. It was really good. Like, we were a little goofy, but it was a good episode and the content was incredible. This episode is a panel with three women, two of which we've had on the show and one of which we will in the future. And one of those women is Julie Baumer, the very first exoneree that I ever interviewed. And she was in her car. And all throughout this episode, I was just thinking about how far this podcast has come, all the places we've been. And it was really an emotional experience. And I don't want it to be ruined by this technical issue. But guys, it's going to be midnight in like 45 minutes. And I don't have time to re-edit it and re-record. So please listen anyway. Even though this one didn't have as much time put into the pre-production, the interview is amazing. Here it is. We are doing our very first women panel episode, and I am so excited. We have three women here, Diane, Julie, and Christine, and my co-host, DeMarco. They are each going to introduce themselves.
My name is Diane Wells. I live in the Raleigh, North Carolina area. 12 years ago, I was convicted of conspiracy to commit money laundering. About 15 months after that, I was acquitted. About another 20 months after that, I was reconvicted. And then I was sentenced by the judge that acquitted me to probation, house arrest, and restitution. And I was just forever changed about what took place, because I had a fairly good education. I had a good family. I had good representation in terms of the case itself. So after all that took place, which was about 6 or 7 years from start to finish, I also just felt like I had to do something to help the system that I saw failing so many people. And I struggled for many years because as a single mom, I had three kids, and I was divorced after the case was over because my husband left. And so I had to figure out just how to support them. And I had to figure out how to be able to make a difference in the system that I knew firsthand had so many problems. So I've slowly but surely figured that out, I hope.
Yes, my name is Christine Bunch. I'm from Indiana. And in 1995, I was charged with arson and murder when I lost my three-year-old son in a fire. It was later proven to be an accidental fire and not an arson at all. But it took 17 years to prove that. And I was 6 months pregnant when I went in. So I walked out to a 16-year-old son. And it's taken a long while to kind of reconnect with him and build a relationship. And I'm glad to say it's moved forward, but it'll never be what a mother should truly have with their child.
Julie Baumer here from Michigan. In 2003, I agreed to do an in-family adoption. My sister had an unplanned pregnancy. And so when my nephew was about 5 weeks old, he became lethargic, if you will. And I took him into the emergency room. And 48 hours later, I was being questioned as a prime suspect in child abuse, if you will. There was bleeding on his brain, and because I was the primary caretaker, they were immediate to point the finger at me. It took them several months to actually formally bring charges against me. I was in my early 20s, limited resources, and I was able to retain an attorney. However, I was not able to afford any expert witnesses on my behalf. And the trial was basically the doctors against me. And so I was found guilty of first-degree child abuse, and I was sentenced to 15 years. And in 2009 with the aid of the Michigan Innocence Clinic. I was able to prove my innocence when several doctors wrote independent affidavits stating that my nephew was not abused at all. In fact, he sadly had suffered a form of childhood stroke, venous sinus thrombosis. And after a second trial, I was acquitted in 2010 and formally exonerated in October of 2010. And, you know, even though there's been several years that have lapsed, the pain is still there, just like it was today, if you will. It's a constant scar.
And he survived.
Yes. He was diagnosed at 6 months of age with cerebral palsy. I actually, at the time, thought the heart of my defense was the fact that my sister was given 2 doses of Pitocin, and her due date wasn't even for 2 more weeks. And usually, from the research that I had done as a layperson, Pitocin is administered when the due date is passed, and that's to help bring on contractions. And so there was a difficult birth. He was actually hospitalized for a week after, and I had limited information because the formal adoption had not gone through. So I was getting secondhand information. When I brought him home, I was under the assumption that he was just going to be a poor, fussy eater for a while. But like I said, 4 weeks later, he just stopped eating completely for me. So, but yeah, at 6 months of age, he was diagnosed with cerebral palsy.
DeMarco, would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is DeMarco Carpenter. In 1994, I was tried and convicted of a murder of a young female by the name of Karen Summers. I ended up receiving a life sentence plus 170 years. I served 22 years. I was released 22 months ago. And since I've been out, I've been talking to the youth, kids all over the U.S. pretty much. I've been trying to stay positive. It's been a struggle, but I'm enjoying this transition from the life that I was living inside a penal institution into this life now as a free man. I'm a co-host of Actual Innocence.
Which is amazing when you think about it, because he was in prison for 22 years when technology took off. So now, you know, he's using technology to pay his rent.
Yes, pretty much. And it's still a struggle, but here I am. You know, I'm staying focused like I was all those years. And, you know, I'm trying to make things happen for myself.
And we are going to start with hymns. It's okay, Brooke. I got this one. Take a rest. Is that hairline slowly starting to move backwards? Any bald spots yet? I mean, I only have one, but it takes up my entire head. To take control of your hair, Less-ness. A one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, sexual wellness for men. Thanks to science, baldness can be optional. Hims connects you with the real doctors and medical-grade solutions to treat hair loss. Answer a few quick questions, and doctors will review and prescribe you science-backed medications for your needs. It's fast and easy, and the products are shipped directly to your door. I highly recommend you take actions with Hims before your bald spots start to emerge like mine.
Wow, that was really great. You've really grown as a podcaster. Order now. Our listeners get a free trial month of Hims for just $5 today, right now while supplies last. See the website for full details. This would cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy. Go to forhims.com/actual.
Go to forhims.com/actual. That's forhims.com/actual.
forhims.com/actual. And so what I noticed is in DeMarco's case, which I know pretty well, a crime happened and they wanted to arrest someone for it. But Julie and Christine, you were both convicted of something that wasn't a crime. And I just wondered if it was your experience while you were incarcerated that was...
I mean, I was exonerated with the help of Northwestern University's Wrongful Conviction Clinic, and they have a women's project. And from their studies of the 204 women that have been exonerated to date, 80% of those, no crime occurred. It was an accident, some kind of a medical issue or genetic issue, and women were charged with these crimes. And of most of the women that I was incarcerated with, I think at least 10% of those in there, that was the case in a child death or a family member, because usually with women, it's someone that's very close to them. And I feel like investigators take advantage of our shock and our pain and our emotional status at that moment and build a case.
I won't dispute those numbers. You know, Christine certainly has her information accurate. However, from my own personal experience, I being a natural introvert, you know, I was incarcerated for 5 years, or four and a half, if you will, but I really didn't inquire about too many things. I mean, you would hear other people talk about other people's cases, but I was really on the mindset of just trying to get out and not trying to get framed or set up for anything. Of course, you know, the nature of my alleged crime had, you know, gotten out to the general public inside, you know, a couple of years after I was in. And, you know, I walked the gauntlet line and, you know, just, you know, took the verbal beatings and whatnot. But, you know, sadly, that's just the way, you know, things are in there. But what I did notice, though, you know, I never specifically asked anybody about their crimes. But I remember just from overhearing conversation or even being a part of conversation, a good majority of those women were in there for victimless crimes. It was because of their drug addiction. And I thought that was very sad.
Addiction is a mental health issue. Absolutely.
And I don't want to go too far off the topic, but just, you know, one lady sticks out in mind. You know, unfortunately, her mother was addicted to heroin. She was the product of a prostitution. You know, she grew up into prostitution. She started tricking when she was 13, got addicted to heroin. By the time she was 18, she was burnt out, but she was still addicted. So she decided to go rob a bank. And she did it through the drive-thru. She didn't even have a gun. She just demanded the money through the drive-thru. They automatically labeled her a bank robber and gave her 15 years instead of looking at alternatives. You know, I just thought it was really sad that the prison was overpopulated with people who had drug addictions versus, you know, actually, you know, causing a crime that where somebody was actually physically or, you know, emotionally damaged. It was more or less like we were the victims. So,
Diane, so what do you think is one of the biggest factors that contributes to wrongful conviction? Do you understand what I mean by that?
Oh, absolutely. No, I've studied this a great deal. I think that one of the biggest factors actually is eyewitness misidentification. I have a friend, Jennifer Camino Thompson, that's lives not too far from me, that I learned about her story a number of different ways, and we've gotten to be good friends. And she was raped when she was in college, and she identified the wrong person and sent him to prison for, I know it was over 10 years. It was actually on 60 Minutes as well. And they wrote a book called Picking Cotton, because his name was Ronald Cotton, that she picked out of a lineup as the man that had raped her. And so he went to prison for something he didn't do. And then the other man that actually did the crime ended up not going free because he continued to do what he had done to Jennifer, and he was caught. And so actually two of them ended up in the same prison at the same time, and people couldn't even tell them apart. That's how similar they looked. You know, that is definitely, I would think, just the most horrible situation, because you already have a crime and now you're having someone else that becomes a part of the situation that really doesn't belong there and has, you know, just just is touching countless people's lives, and it's just a lie what's going on.
Julie, I was stalking you on the internet looking for your email earlier. You were on 60 Minutes, weren't you?
There was a piece that aired back in January of 2016, and they were speaking in regards to the lack of compensation. They had two other exonerees on there from different states, and they were just talking about how some states don't compensate. Here in Michigan, however, they did pass a law. Not because of that show. They've been working on this law for several years, but unfortunately, it's not an easy process as one would think. One would think that if your life was taken away overnight and immediately, that after you would be found exonerated and after you would file a claim and after the court would, or the judge would see that you fit the criteria as the bill is written, you would expect to be compensated. However, that's not the case. There are the states actually filing dismissals left and right, clogging up the court system, spending more taxpayers' money for something that we are entitled to. There are several of us here in Michigan who are currently basically having to reprove our innocence just to be compensated.
I have a question for everybody. Did anyone get an apology from anybody in the system?
I'll take that.
I would like to hear everybody's answer. So whoever wants to go first.
No. Never.
Julie here. And I honestly thought that after the bill was passed, that would give me some form of emotional closure. You know, like that would be the state in their eyes acknowledging that they did wrongfully incarcerate a citizen. I haven't experienced that closure, and it certainly has nothing to do with the money, because the amount is laughable, $50,000 a year. You could go up to anybody right now and ask them if to take away a year from their life and their loved ones and whatnot, would they take that? But
did you ever get an apology? And I'm sorry.
Actually, the judge, after the not guilty verdict was brought down, and then the prosecutor and the and my defense attorney went in to interview the jury. The judge who was actually the judge on my first trial, he came up to me and he just, you know, he extended his hand and he said, I'm sorry that you went through this. And I'm very grateful that you have the outcome that you have today, because now I can sleep. So obviously it was bothering him from day one.
That's amazing, because I don't hear that very often. Diane, did you get a thing? Did you get an I'm sorry?
No. Well, what I got was a little unusual. I've been told how unusual my case has been. And that's just that since I was convicted, acquitted, and reconvicted and sentenced, but never went to jail, what I got is when the judge was talking to me about what happened, I literally carry this around with me so I can speak verbatim what he said. He said, after I gave my allocution to the court and I'm being sentenced, he said, I think the government is very powerful, and sometimes all a private person has is the truth to stand between them, and it might not prevail. And in order to anyway save yourself now in the criminal process, you can't rely on a judge and a jury. You have to make some accommodation with the government and plead guilty, because the consequences of not pleading guilty are so profound that it's not worth the risk.
Right. It's such a terrible dilemma.
Yeah. I mean, here is the judge that acquitted me that's now sentencing me, and he doesn't know what the hell to do. And so I just felt like I was hearing the judge's pain. It was no longer talking about my case. He was talking about a system that's broken that he's held hostage to. He's probably been on the bench for 30 years, and he's just telling me that he can't do his job because of how our system is at this point.
Audiobooks are a great sidekick for summer activities like hiking, sunbathing on the beach, road tripping. And listening is a better way to binge content you love while doing things you love. Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet, which lets you fill your summer with more stories like I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara, which I downloaded earlier, or West Cork. I mean, even the cover on that one is incredible. And I've heard the part in between the front and back covers is even better. Audible helps you listen to more books by letting you switch seamlessly between devices, picking up exactly where you left off, whether it's on your phone, through your car, from a tablet, or at home with an Amazon Echo, you can get through tons of books. Audible members get a credit card every month, good for any audiobook in our store, regardless of price. And unused credits roll over to the next month. Didn't like your audiobook? You can exchange it. No questions asked. Plus, your books are yours to keep. With Audible, you can go back and re-listen anytime, even if you cancel your membership.
Start a 30-day trial and your first audiobook is free. Go to audible.com/actual or text actual to 500-500.
After starting a 30-day trial, your first audiobook is free. You just visit audible.com/actual or you text the word actual to 500-500.
audible.com/actual. You can do it with audiobooks.
Diane said that she thought that people who have been accused of crime are oftentimes wrongly convicted because of false witness testimony. I'm going to go with Christine first. Christine, what do you think is the biggest factor that contributes to the wrongful conviction of a non-crime?
The biggest factor would probably be misinterpretation of forensic science technology. I mean, if you look at shaken baby syndrome, arson, there's so many things out there. Even DNA, we're improving DNA testing all the time. And so I feel like until we really can say we have a scientific method for backing up what we're saying, we shouldn't trust experts who come in and say, I walked through that crime scene and I saw this, this, and this, and that indicates such and such. Because those people are sending people to prison and they have no expertise, no training. It's not even required.
Julie, do you agree with that? Or
there's multiple factors. In my opinion, though, and I'm speaking solely based around my case, human error. It was absolute human error. The doctor that testified against me misread the radiology scans. That's it. They misdiagnosed. And when it came time for them to be confronted about that, their words, quote unquote, were, I've been in practice for X amount of years. I have a family, I have a reputation, and if I was wrong about this one, how many others have I been wrong about? I'm not going there. And he refused to change his testimony. So even being confronted with five other colleagues, their affidavits, which were independently written and came to the same conclusion, he did not want to admit that he was wrong.
Right.
Human error.
DeMarco, how was that for you? Like, what do you think were the factors that led to your wrongful conviction?
It was a number of things, but definitely coercion. And I do think that judges, DAs, apology, it should be mandatory. You know, I never received an apology either, but definitely coercion in my case.
And so, obviously, if a system convicts innocent people and a jury of 12 people find someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and they're not guilty, something is broken. What do you think is something that needs to happen to help fix the justice system?
Oh, gosh, that's like a big, huge question. You know, I mean, there's so many different factors. We have without a doubt, one of the best criminal justice systems in the world. But And again, it's in my opinion, when we have human error, it's like, you know, the wheels aren't turning. And when the wheels aren't turning, things get jammed up. And so in order to keep the wheels turning, you've got to have honesty and an integrity. You've got to have the humility to admit when you're wrong. I mean, there's just so many different factors. You know, instead of, you know, you hear about these prosecutors, you know, holding evidence that could prove a defendant's innocence, you know, because they want to win that case. They want to, they want, oh my gosh, this is what I'm here to do, is to prosecute. I mean, and they lose sight of what they actually, why they got into law. They lose sight of why they took that oath to honor and protect. I mean, it's just, it's sad. It's sad.
One of my best friends is a post-conviction attorney, and she said to me, she was telling me about a case, and she said, you know, it's definitely a case of, I'm going to say it wrong, but where ineffective assistance to counsel. And I said, but isn't it the job of the counsel to, like, fall on his sword and be like, yeah, you're right, like, I didn't do it? She's like, you'd think that, but human pride is so, like...
Absolutely. The prosecutor in my case, when asked by my defense team the second time around, why are you prosecuting? Why aren't you just dismissing this case? Why would you even recharge this woman? And his response to them was, it's an election year. I need the public to know that I'm tough on crime. Any jury's going to find her out. You just let it play out. I don't want anything to do with it. That, how pathetic is that? I mean, that's four weeks of trauma on me. I mean, because a jury can back and say, can say anything. I mean, we already know this from round one, right? So it's sad. It's human pride. You're right. In my case, I always tell people it's pride and prejudice. Pride and prejudice. They don't want to admit they're wrong, and it's sad.
Christine, what do you think is something that needs to happen to help fix the issues in the justice system?
We need to take away immunity. Anytime that a prosecutor withholds evidence, anytime that an expert tampers with evidence, anytime that an injustice happens in a courtroom and a judge sees it and does nothing, they need to be held accountable for those mistakes. There should be nobody that has complete power and gets to take away years, decades from somebody's life and scar them to where some people never return from and they walk away scot-free. They should have to answer for what they did, and they should face the same amount of time as the person you sent away.
If, when I was working for someone else, you know, if I made a mistake, like, I was reprimanded. Like, I didn't have immunity for my mistakes. And my actions didn't affect people the way that these people's actions do.
Absolutely.
And Diane, what do you think are some things that need to happen to fix the problems in the justice system?
Well, I can't help but just to agree with what's been said already, and also just say, you know, the culture and the belief system that's in the criminal justice system, at least from the prosecutors' standpoint, I mean, I just found it to be reprehensible. I mean, just as someone else has said here, I knew that there was an agenda that was going on for them to go after the man that owned the company that I worked for. And I don't really know whether he committed a crime or not, but basically what they did is took down about 12 people in different companies that he was affiliated with, trying to get him to plead guilty. And I happen to know, I know most of those people, and they didn't do anything wrong, but they just kept pleading guilty to things because that's what they were advised to do. And I just couldn't do that. But that's what happened, and it was all because, just as what was stated earlier, it was an election year, and that was the agenda of what was going on. These are the people we're going after, and whether they did anything or they didn't, this is what we're going to do, because there was no crime committed in my case. I mean, the case was money laundering, and there was no money that I never received a dime, and that's really, I know what the judge acquitted me about, because the forensic accounting that they did never showed any money going into any accounts other than my salary, which I've been getting for, you know, would be the amount of time I'd worked there. So that made no sense. So the culture and the belief system that's going on there is just, you know, the average person would never understand it. They just have to meet it. The weight of the system has to kind of fall on you for you to understand who they are and how they conduct themselves. I mean, this is not, I never had a jury of my peers. They didn't know what the heck they didn't know anything about the business that I was in and who I was. And I mean, it was a fiasco. So, you know, really, if everybody that ever committed a crime was prosecuted, there wouldn't be any people left too. I mean, everybody's done something wrong. Prosecutors can find something somebody did and charge them. You know, there's an old adage about charging a ham sandwich, and it's just ridiculous, but it's true. And I do believe, because I've been exposed to this enough through sitting in courtrooms, that prison isn't the answer for a lot of people that have drugs and mental health problems. But, you know, we need to get systems in there that can help these people with their addictions and their difficulties. And I saw that time after time, and I just thought that was a tragedy. And I happen to work right now with a psychiatrist, and she has definitely concurred with that the systems that we used to have to help people with mental health are almost non-existent at this point, and that's why people go to prison, and it doesn't help anybody. One other thing, I've worked with some innocence commissions in my area and otherwise, and one thing that I thought was very, very important, because it's helped to get some people out of jail, was to never get rid of any evidence that was a part of the case until the person has actually gotten out of jail or has passed and their family says it's okay. Because, you know, there have been people that have just unexpectedly found something that ties back into a case where somebody's been sitting in jail, and just absolutely, you know, there's no words to describe when they come forward with some evidence that wasn't presented, and now all of a sudden it's appearing. You know, it's just abominable what's happening.
And my take on this is, it's really sad, but I think that a lot of the DAs and judges, they be friends.
Well, for some reason, we have now put them in a position where they feel like they can never stand up and say, we made a mistake. And I don't understand that, because you have immunity. There are no repercussions for you. Look at how many presidents we've had that have had to stand up and say, yes, I was part of this scandal and I'm very sorry. Oh my God, we didn't get rid of them. We didn't kick them out. They didn't lose their job. We need to change their mindset to where they say, hey, you know, you're right. I can't get another conviction in front of a jury because this new evidence has come to light and we simply made a mistake, and let it go.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
If you're a fan of Actual Innocence or next week, Buried Alive, just admit it. You love true crime, which is totally okay, because I do too. So let me tell you about the new podcast I love. When you think of a criminal, what do you picture? Do you picture a murderer? A gangster? Do you picture a woman? Yeah, I didn't either. I didn't want to think that women were capable of such terrible things. And that's why I'm hooked on the new podcast, Female Criminals.
Every week, the host of Female Criminals take a psychological approach to analyzing the stories and motivations of the women behind some of the world's most dangerous crimes. Each episode analyzes the psychology of these criminals, looking into their minds to better understand their motives.
The hosts deep dive into the lives of infamous female criminals, providing listeners with each woman's backstory and details of her crime. You can check out the episodes on The Cocaine Godmother now. And with a new episode coming out every Wednesday, you can expect episodes on Eileen Wuornos and many more. Visit Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts, and search for Female Criminals. That's FemaleCriminals. Or visit Parcast.com/criminals to start listening now.
That's Parcast, Parcast.com/criminals to listen now.
Parcast.com/criminals. What are the things that you need the most when you go home?
Everything. I mean, I walked out with my prison uniform. I didn't even have a toothbrush. I didn't know where I was going to live. I didn't know what I was going to do with this teenage son I had. I didn't know where I was going to get clothes, where I was going to get shelter, where I was going to get food, let alone worrying about, you know, doctors, dentists, counselors, trying to beef up a resume with a 17-year gap so that I can get a job and support myself and my child. Literally, I mean, it's just a mountain and you don't know where to start first or where to go to get those things.
Were there any kind of programs or assistance that was available to you?
No. And the one program that I tried to get into was a reentry program. I wanted help with my resume so it didn't look like I had a 17-year-old hole. I wanted, you know, some advice and tips on how I can beef that up and move right into the workforce. And I was told I was ineligible because I no longer had a conviction.
So if you were actually guilty, you would have had more resources when you were released.
Oh, yes. I would have had housing, transportation. I probably could have got food stamps, help paying my bills, job placement, job training. The list goes on.
I have to mirror everything that Christine just shared. You know, I mean, when I was incarcerated, immediately, you know, we were all told, okay, it's going to at least be 2 years for the appeal. Okay, so we hunker down for the 2 years. Well, after I lost my first and then my second appeal, the letters and the pictures and the financial assistance started tapering off from my siblings. And I questioned my father as to, you know, why this would be. And of course, they lived out of state. You know, I was in my mid-20s when I was convicted. Everybody was already married and spread out and doing their own thing. And sadly, the response that came back from one of my sisters was, well, you know, we're sad that you're in this situation. You know, we stuck with you through your appeals, but we're raising our own children. We're raising our families, and we cannot do the time with you. And that was just the way it was. My response was, well, I know you're raising your family, but guess what? Everybody has to eat. And even if everybody stands in line at the grocery store, I don't care who you are. And you can't take 5-10 minutes to, you know, just send me a greeting card just to know that I'm being thought of on the outside. You know, that was a little painful, but yeah, that was the reality of the situation. When I was actually released, I didn't have anybody here. My siblings were out of state. My parents were elderly, living in a senior complex, you know, living off of Social Security. I went to a homeless shelter. I was at a homeless shelter for a week until I had somebody take me in, and I was fortunate enough to start doing some manual labor, you know, with their company. And then after and mind you, from the time I was released to the time I was exonerated, 10 months went by. You know, I was on a tether and whatnot, waiting for my second trial. But after I was formally exonerated, I was able to start putting together a resume. And of course, yeah, a gap does affect you because you have to explain what's happening. And when you tell them what's happening, you don't get calls back. So I learned after several attempts, failed attempts to just stop sharing why I had a gap, or I blatantly lied. I told them I had a sick family member out of state and I was out of state taking care of the family member. I mean, I didn't know what else to say. I got accepted for a couple of positions and then you just, you know, keep moving forward.
Did you also have the experience where if you would have been actually guilty, that there would have been programs to help you?
So in every state, there's reentry services for everybody who's paroled. You know, if you do the crime, you do your time, and then you get paroled, they help you reintegrate back into society. It's not a perfect reentry because guess what? There's a lot of people that come back, but nonetheless, they just don't boot you out. I mean, I left the prison at 5 o'clock in the morning, went to court, was told, yes, your conviction's been overturned, but now the state wants to retry you. So basically you're starting from fresh. We got to come up with bond money for you. You got to get a tether agent. So now we're going to send you to the county jail to wait about 12 hours for all of this to transpire, because you got to get money together from the outside and this and that and all this other stupid stuff. And sadly, I didn't have anybody, you know, waiting on me. So they dressed me out. You know, they dressed me out in clothes that were, you know, just abandoned there. Oversized jeans, a sweat hoodie that belonged to who knows who. I mean, they were clean, but nonetheless, you know, just the way they released me. And of course, no financial assistance, no nothing. And I bet your jeans didn't have Fat Albert on the ass. And then, right. So I got to go to Meijer in that getup, and I was fortunate enough to have a friend of my parents. They were able to take me to Meijer, and they gave me a loan, $150, to go in and just basically I grabbed a duffel bag, and if I was going to stay overnight somewhere, just start throwing what you need, and you know, you pick up some sweats and some tennis shoes, and just at least you're sort of getting there. But yeah, it's a tough road back. And, you know, and then even so, you know, it's like they took my life from me, and then they gave it back, you know, in pieces. You know, I'm trying to put this jigsaw puzzle together, and there's a lot of missing pieces. It's never going to be complete. It's never going to be the way it was.
My ex-husband at first did believe me, but then I think he saw what was happening as a way for him to get basically our children and all of our assets and have me go away. So I watched him transform from somebody who I thought was my life partner to somebody who was greedy and despicable. And so, you know, I physically saw him talking to the prosecutors, which is a violation of my rights. And of course, my attorney said accordingly. And you know, I had one or two family members that I thought were really good, and then I had some others that were so in awe of what the criminal justice system was that they started questioning me in a way that I couldn't have ever imagined. I had business colleagues that were absolutely aligned with me and friends that were absolutely as well. And then I had others that I felt like, you know, they didn't know me at all the way I thought they did. And I remember having to get character letters. Now, I remember getting 36 character letters, and every time I got them, I couldn't open them. And finally, you know, I'd put them in this big envelope to take the attorney, and then we had to open them all up. And I just said, this is like being at your own funeral, because you really found out what people thought about you one way or another. You know, it was just it was a very compelling situation, just trying to understand, you know, why people said what they did. And, you know, they have their perspective on who you are. And it's a very humbling process.
Does North Carolina have a standard compensation for a wrongful conviction?
I'm aware of a couple of companies like Defy Ventures and 70 Million Jobs, which definitely are, you know, aligned with trying to get people that were incarcerated work that includes working with business partners throughout the country. And I'm just starting to talk to them because I'm pretty excited, and I want to be a part of the solution. I want to hire people that have been incarcerated. I think they'll do a better job and create the culture that I'm looking for to go forward, because nobody can understand that more than somebody who's gone through it.
This is not an advertisement, but we did an interview a couple of weeks ago, and one of our sponsors is called ZipRecruiter. It wasn't an ad in this episode, and we were talking, and the man that we were talking to said, I got a job the day after I was released. And we're like, well, how did you do that? And he said, I used ZipRecruiter. So that was so amazing to me that one of our supporters had supported one of our exonerees. Like, it was just an awesome feeling.
Absolutely. We have to help each other, because, I mean, that's why I'm doing what I'm doing, is that, you know, I don't know how to fix the government per se. I know that I'm one person. I know that the more that I can reach out to people and have something substantive to offer them, which in my case is creating awareness about what a criminal justice nonprofit does, as well as, you know, give them funding to do the work that they're doing. I feel like that's as much as what I can do. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Christine, I also live in Indiana. Do you know, are there compensation laws in Indiana?
There is nothing in Indiana, and there is nothing. And there is nothing in looming up in the future. I mean, Indiana is a predominantly good old boy state, and we are conservative. So when it comes time to open the wallet, nobody wants to do that. So it's an uphill battle. It's one of the things that I work on, and we go and speak, and we do have several community members who are trying to push forward an agenda for compensation.
I said I have a question for Julie. So Julie, last time we talked, you was telling me a bit about your book. Tell us about your book.
I didn't write a book about my case. If I ever did, I don't have the energy to do that just yet. But when I was incarcerated, to relieve myself from absolute boredom and to stay mentally stimulated, I did a lot of writing. And in 2012, I found myself in a financial crunch in between jobs. And, I'd already been home for a couple of years, so I had a few responsibilities, outgoing bills and whatnot. And so I dug in my footlocker, and the manuscript that I had actually completed, I self-published on Amazon. Sadly, I only received sympathy buys from that. And I couldn't afford an editor. So because I hand wrote it in prison, and then I went ahead and I was reading it with that dragon speech. Well, that's not altogether because it's the punctuation. It's poor editing in a lot of areas. I can't say, maybe it wasn't a good story, but it was just a little murder mystery that, I wrote trying to release some tension called Undeserved Sentence. There is somebody who gave me assistance to edit it. I just haven't had the, again, it comes down to energy. You know, I mean, you can only, focus on so much. And when you have primary obligations, you have to put secondary dreams on the back burner and go where primary assistance and income is going to come from.
Is it still on Amazon?
It still is on Amazon, and if, like I said, I think it's a good story, but I need to put an edited version in there. So.
You mentioned earlier that Michigan does have a state compensation, and can you explain it more? You said it's $50,000 a year?
Yeah, they've been working on getting this law. It's now a law. They've been working on getting the bill. They were working actively on a bill for almost 12 years. They were trying to get this law passed, and they finally did. It was formally passed in March of 2017. So, and the way the bill reads is that, basically if you're found to be exonerated, you can receive up to $50,000 per year and then that's tax-free, and then the attorneys, they have a cap on what they can get, but it doesn't come out of the exonerees' money. It comes, the state pays for that, so they have a cap of $50,000 on that, so for any attorney who files it.
Do you have a guess, or do you know how long between someone is released and before they're compensated? Because I'm picturing you living in a homeless shelter, needing this money, and it not coming for years.
Right. Well, mind you, I wasn't exonerated when I was released. My conviction was overturned, but then the state that day decided to retry me, or decided to recharge. So, certainly after I was formally exonerated, though, you would think that, reentry services would have certainly assisted me. And then after exoneration, I would think that, file a claim in the courts, but why are we taking it to another degree of fighting it and trying to get it dismissed and then trying to make me prove my innocence? You know, somebody should be exonerated, and within, I don't know, I mean, how long does it take for a judge to sign a piece of paper? I mean, it shouldn't take that long. So, immediate assistance, and, you know, it's the way it's supposed to be.
I have noticed that many people who have been exonerated or who have been wronged by the system use their life to make sure this doesn't happen to other people. And so I know Christine has Justice for Just Us. And so could you just tell us a little bit about how your organization works?
Okay, so we are a 501c3, and we accept literally anything that would help an exoneree rebuild their life, reintegrate. Basically, what started it was I went to work at Northwestern University, and I was embraced by a community. And they made things comfortable for me because I was scared to get on the bus by myself, and I didn't want to go try new things or go someplace because I felt like people would know who I was and they would talk about me, and it was just uncomfortable. And so I had all of these people supporting me and, I mean, telling me where I needed to go and, you know, bringing me hand-knitted sweaters and taking me out to dinner and just, you know, giving you the skills all around. So we started the organization to do that. And we've helped take new exonerees to their first innocence conference so they can bond with their brothers and sisters. We've done hygiene baskets for people as they've come out, because I know what it's like to come out without a toothbrush or a bar of soap. We have, you know, reached out to different groups. We're going to try to do counseling. We're going to try to do support groups. And we're also in the process of creating two new charitable agents in two other states who are exonerees. Julie Balmer is one of them. So I'm doing the paperwork now so we can get Michigan and Pennsylvania under the J4J umbrella. That would be awesome. Kirk Bloodsworth is going to be our agent. So we're doing the paperwork right now so I can get them up and running. And we also take services. I've had a lot of dentists and doctors donate services instead of just giving money. So for us, it's not just about giving money. It's about, you know, taking care of their immediate needs and making sure they're well.
So Diane.
Supply Justice.
Yes. Can you tell me how it works?
So we're just getting started, but Supply Justice is an e-commerce company that we sell different kinds of supplies, hopefully basically catering to the legal community. I've aligned with a company that will give me wholesale prices on brand name products, so like Nike and Adidas and 3M and all kinds of apparel and office supply type things. And what we're doing, as much as anything, is we want to be able to put logos on these. That's one of the ways that I'm able to get such a good discount on these items, is because I get them at wholesale. And then you know, if ABC law firm, for example, is having a golf outing and they want to put their name on all of their golf shirts and trophies or whatever, then we can do all that. And then the net profits from the sale of whatever someone's purchasing, they choose the nonprofit they want to give the money to. So 100% of the net profit goes to wherever they want it to go. Because I just never wanted this to be about me. I don't know enough about all of the different places out there that can help people. But for a law firm, for whomever wants to be able to throw the donations at where they feel like, you know, they know somebody's doing good work, as long as it's a criminal justice nonprofit in the United States that qualifies as an approved nonprofit. And that's what I'm doing right now, is actually talking to people to see, you know, if you want to have your nonprofit listed on my site, we'll put it up there. And as people start to learn about who they are and buy things, then the donations start to go out. So it's creating awareness, it's creating funding, and I'm reaching out to all the Innocence Projects right now, because I just went to the conference, as you all did as well, in Memphis, and started meeting people. And so I'm just connecting with them. And just now, I will tell you that the thing that I can really do better than anything else, and how I literally have supported my family since, well, not since the day that, you know, I was basically on my own again, but Of course, I lost my job and everything. Obviously, I lost everything when this all took place. And when I restarted, one of the things I was able to do is start sourcing products. So it's basically retail arbitrage. I find places where I can buy something at $1 and sell it at $2 or $3. And, you know, when I can do that, it's not about me getting paid. It's about giving as much away as we possibly can. And so sourcing those products are what I do, I think, kind of well. And that's my, I have a business background and I'm just putting systems together. I'm taking classes even for supply chain management to get as good as we possibly can in being able to get as much sourcing done well to just increase the amount of profits we can give away. That's what I want to do, just give it away.
When I listen to you talk, it sounds very much like things that I say. Because, you know, my degree is in mental health and addictions, and I was a therapist, and I didn't know wrongful convictions happened. And as a therapist, I didn't feel like there was a whole lot I could do, but I could talk. So I got a microphone, started talking in my closet about these problems, and my hope was that I would reach someone that did know how to fix the problem. So when you say those things, it makes me feel very much like how it was when I started also.
Yeah. I mean, I did think about becoming an attorney at one point because I worked so hard on my case, and my attorney actually wanted to hire me when I got done with it. That's what he saw. He saw passion. He saw hard work. He saw, you know, I never worked harder at anything in my life. And yet, you know, I just didn't think that was the right course of action because then I only felt like I'd be helping whoever it is that came through his door. And I just felt like I had a higher calling than that. I didn't feel like, and I'm a Christian. I felt like that God had put me in this situation because I could make a difference like that. And so it took me years to come up with this. I joined a bunch of trade associations. I joined the American Bar Association. I know this is crazy, but I actually ended up at the Supreme Court because I was at the National Association of Women Judges conference, and they had a tour of the Supreme Court, and there was a reception there, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor were there. And sure enough, you know, I'm sitting there talking to two Supreme Court justices and asking them, you know, what would they do? Because
good for you. Good for you to take that initiative.
Yeah. Well, it's not about me. It's about a system that is not doing the right thing and countless people are suffering and I can't stand it. And I just felt like
right.
I became a part of it. And now that when you know better like that, you just never leaves you. It just becomes a part of who you are.
But it is a part of you. It's your character. Your character is to not be one of those people who look away when there's a problem. You solve the problem.
You do think you didn't think you could do. I will tell you that. And I bet these ladies feel the same way. There are things you never thought you would do.
Currently, I'm a real estate agent, and I'm contracted under Coldwell Banker, Ware Manual. And that website that would take you directly to my website, which I would hope nobody would have to log in to get into, that's www.cbwm.com/JBaumer, B-A-U-M-E-R. I do some local speaking at, you know, the University of Michigan.
Well, actually, I was looking, you had some beautiful houses for sale. So if I wanted to move to Michigan, you're my woman.
I would hope if anybody was looking for any property in Michigan, they would contact me.
This is my last question. And Julie kind of just answered it without me even asking it. But I just wonder, how is your life going now? So, Christine, do you want to go first with that one?
Well, it's going. I mean, every day is you work and you try to make a living and try to make sure all your bills are paid and do as much good as you can. And educate as many people as you can, because I certainly don't want this to ever happen again. In my free time, I hang out with my kid, which is really cool because, you know, he's an adult now and he does a lot of things that just make me cry because my baby should not be 21 already. But I mean, it's good. I'm free in one sense, but I feel like this is still a weight around my neck, and
I just drag it along until one day I can say, you know what, I'm good. I don't have to worry what's going to come tomorrow, and life can just seem normal.
Yeah, it certainly was a challenge. Yeah.
Diane, how are you doing now?
Well, I feel like I went through what I went through to do what I'm starting to do right now. I feel like there's no way that I ever would have been in this situation where I'm helping people the way that I am if I hadn't had that experience. So, you know, I'm unexpectedly, I think, grateful to have had that experience. And I feel like, I mean, how many people really feel like they have a specific purpose in life? And I do feel like this is something that I just have to do. I mean, it's like, for me, there's just no plan B. This is going to happen. I want the people that are doing the good work to be able to have the funding and awareness so that others can appreciate what they're doing and that our system can be more of what it's supposed to be. So I'm happy. You know, I've got great kids. I've got my health.
And I want to thank you all for taking the time to talk with us today. This has been super enlightening. And I'm actually going to turn it over to DeMarco because he has the experience of being an exoneree, he has some interesting insight.
I just have one question. I just want to know, has PTSD played a part in any of y'all's life?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're all a little loony. You know, it's like going to war, coming back, you're just not the same person. Yeah. Especially, like I said, I got missing pieces. You know, I lost my nephew. I mourned that he didn't pass, but that's a cross I bear every day that I didn't have the opportunity to raise him. My mother passed 2 weeks after I came home suddenly from a stroke. How ironic. You know, just lost memories. Those were formative years for me. I was 27 when I went in, and I was almost 34 when I came out. I mean, how do you, those are... just those are important years. You know, I'm single and I have no children. Things I'm sure would have been different if I wasn't taken away from my life. You know, and then my nephews and nieces, I was always very close with all of them, but sadly they outgrew me when I came home, and that's the only way I can explain it. You know, they were, you know, young children, preteens, and I came home and half of them are adults and half of them are in late teens, and you know, they're being their age, but not realizing, you know, they can't be little for me anymore. And that's just the way it is. So they outgrew me.
So thank you all so much for being a part of this. And you all have my total respect because you could have just walked away. Like, you could have tried to forget that this ever happened, but you're helping prevent it from happening to other people. And I think that that's amazing.
Oh, thank you.
I'm Brooke. Thank you so much for listening.